Dave. Good evening, Lee.
Apologies, I was just watching in the opening titles for Street Hawk, The Man, The Machine.
Vaguely.
Welcome, listeners. Tonight, the theme is ridiculous crime fighters from the 80s.
Oh, yeah, baby.
There are so many of them. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is what we grew up with, really. And
yeah, the dross.
They were on all the bloody time, weren't they?
We came out of the 1970s because we were influenced by the 70s, because by the time the 80s came along, by the time 1980 came along, I was 12 years old. God, thinking about it, 11, 12 years old. So I had been heavily influenced by Starsky and Hutch and Kojak and Cannon, these ones from the 70s, which
Streets of San Francisco.
Oh, the Streets of San Francisco. Love that, with bum nose Carl Malden and soon to be massive film star Michael Douglas. So you never would have thought it at the time. You'd have just thought, oh yeah, that's Kirk Douglas's son, he's just a TV actor. And yeah, I love the Streets of San Francisco too, you know, with that mad theme tune at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know. Hey, Quinn Martin production.
Well, I'm going to play your theme tune, Dave. See if you can get this one. This was one of the biggest shows of the 80s.
I'll bring it on. God, what is it? I know it so well. I'd be kicking myself. Yeah, go on.
Quincy.
I was going to say, is it Quincy? But yeah. That's too good. That's a good one. That's why it threw me, because that's Quincy's a pretty good show.
I know, but he overreached, didn't he? He was a pathologist. He was a medical examiner or whatever, and he just started solving crimes without permission. No, did you notice though when you watched Quincy, the police were never there, were they? There was no real police investigation. It'd just be Quincy arguing with the DA.
Yeah.
You know, and he had 48 hours. His boss had the DA on his back. Every single bloody episode.
I always remember though, it was a American TV show that used to get really good reviews in British newspapers. I remember we always used to get the Daily Telegraph, you know, in our house, you know, bit of a despicably Tory household that we were living in. And that would always have like reviews, one or two stars. And if you got a one star, that was really good. You know, two star was like really excellent. So that two stars would be like something like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy or whatever. But Quincy would always get like one star every week. And the person reviewing it would always say, very accurate medical procedure that follows this fine show, you know, this kind of thing. But I never used to watch, I just didn't watch it very often. I recognised the theme tune immediately, but I didn't watch it very often. It was a bit of a bore to me. And at that time, you know, I think what happened was, see, those 70s programmes, when you look back at them now, like Starsky and Hutch and stuff, that seems so brilliant. You look at them now, and they're pretty naff, really, in many respects.
I've never really rewatched them. I know that you can get them now and that, but I've never...
Do you know what? We watched an episode, Jackie and me, and it was really quite enjoyable, even though it was pretty naff. But what was enjoyable about it was the chemistry between Paul Michael Glazer and David Soul. That was kind of really quite nice, you know. There was that kind of that buddy... kind of, and almost a little bit knowing, you know, which was good. But in retrospect, I bet if I watched an episode of Cannon now, I'd just fucking laugh. Mm. The idea that William Conrad was some kind of tough guy detective, you know, he could barely get out of his fucking Lincoln Continental, you know, role. He was that fat and immobile, and he used to karate chop. He used to give people karate chops and knock them out. You know, it's like.
Well, that reminds me, because I was thinking of where this all started. You know, this sort of far-fetched crime fighter theme. And possibly you could say, what's his face? The one in the wheelchair. What's the one in the Ironside?
Oh, yeah, Ironside. Raymond Burr. Yeah, probably did.
Because wasn't he pursuing people in his wheelchair?
No, that's it. It always had to have a twist. The American shows, they always had to be a fucking twist, didn't they? So it's either someone who couldn't walk, someone who was blind, right? Someone who was fat. You know, a dark, fuzzy-haired one and a blonde one. You know, an Aryan cop and a Jewish cop. Let's be honest. That's what Starsky Nuts was.
All right.
The Aryan boy getting on beautifully with the Jewish boy.
Yeah, there's always some... Yes, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, but I think Glenn A. Larson, if you see who produced these shows or came up with the ideas, I think Glenn A. Larson's one of the biggest culprits because he came up with Quincy, Knight Rider, and possibly my favourite one, Manimal.
Oh, you beat me to it. I've got a bit of paper in front of me now, and it said, make sure I mention Manimal. You bloody beat me to it.
Sorry.
Oh, you sod.
Well, you know what? Before we came on air, Dave, I ordered the Manimal Annual, which is available for about £3.46 from eBay, free postage. Maybe we should start with Manimal. Christ on a bike.
Because I was going to save it to the end and say, well, you know, a lot of these procedural cop shows that had like lots of little twists to them, like Knight Rider and what have you, with, you know, a car with a computer. Wow, that's so space age, man. But Manimal went into this kind of paranormal fantasy, you know.
So for people that don't know, Manimal was, he was like a secret agent, and he had the ability to change into any animal he wanted, though I think budget restraints meant that he could only really change into either a panther, a snake, or an eagle. Because I was watching some clips before, and it shows like every single change, because there was only 8 episodes of Manimal. Though the eagle one's quite funny, because what they do to give you an idea of what he's going to change into, they intercut him changing with the animal he's going to become. Because the special effects aren't amazing, as you may guess. Though they were done by Stan Winston, which I was surprised to find out. But there was one where he keeps intercutting with a pigeon. And you think, oh, this will be good. What's he going to do as a pigeon? But then he just becomes an eagle. It was like, what happened there? You know, could they not find any stock footage of an eagle? But the problem with Manimal, if you've seen the transformations, is they're really slow. Probably because they spent so much money on the special effects that they thought, oh, well, we want to get our money's worth here. By the time he's changed, the villains ran off, or the person he was about to save, drowning from quicksand, is dead.
Yeah.
So there was one bit where, what's the face off Flash Gordon's in it? The girl.
Now, I was going to say, the best bit in Manimal by far was the girl with the overbite. Oh, yeah. It was in Flash Gordon. That was the only reason for me to watch a bit of Manimal, because I had a bit of a thing for her when I was a kid. And I thought, oh, yeah, she's great. But McCorkindale was one of, you know, I know he's passed away now, God rest his soul and everything, but I have to say, it's one of the worst actors of all time. If anyone gets a chance to see Baby, which is a Nigel Neal adaptation. In fact, most Nigel Neal adaptations that were done on ITV, all the actors shouting it. If you've ever seen the Stone Tape, it's unbelievable. People just shouting at each other. It's like, what? There's a ghost! I've told you already, there's a ghost! It's in the room! And no more so than Baby. It's incredible. He plays a vet in it, doesn't he? Yeah. And he just shouts at his wife all the time and shouts at people, look at the state of me! Look at the state of my clothes!
Yeah, what I was going to say is there's a bit where it's Melody Anderson, the actress from Flash Gordon and Manimal, and she is sinking in quicksand, and Manimal is like changing, you know, taking his time, and you think, oh, well, what's he going to do? What's he going to become to save her from this? And he becomes a snake. Now, the clip cut off before I could see what the snake actually did, but how does a snake save someone from quicksand? Crazy.
I'm in better metamorphosizing into a big log or something. Or a vine, not a fucking snake.
Or maybe it was like the Indiana Jones clip in Crystal Skull where Indy was sinking and they threw him a snake. But there was nothing holding onto the other end of the snake, so that wouldn't have worked.
Well, I think it was like, obviously, the producers of Manamore had never seen Space 1999. There was an actress in that who called her character's name was Maya, and she kept transforming into animals, didn't she? So we'd already had this idea of someone who could metamorphosize into some kind of animal. Maya could change into fucking anything. Whereas Manimal, like you said, it was always like a fucking leopard. And then you'd have 5 minutes of this kind of like stock footage of a leopard, like giving you, like educating the audience. This is what a leopard looks like. Manimal will become a leopard. Just so bad. It was some shite, wasn't there? Man from Atlantis, you know.
Yeah, I thought of that before. What was the premise of that?
That was before Dallas. I don't know if that was the 80s. Sort of underwater crime, yeah. I don't really know. He just sort of swam about, like, holding his breath.
Yeah, that was his one crime-fighting skill. He could hold his breath. There was some funny footage when Manimal is changing. Some of it looks all right, where he's got, like, he always starts with a pulsating hand. So the pulsating hand is either going to be a paw or a claw, right? Then you'll see like close-ups of his face. If it's going to be a panther, it'll start darkening and his jaw will start to elongate. Though it's not very good. It's not like American Werewolf in London. Then they'll always have this puppet head. And it's, I swear to God, it's like a Thunderbird's puppet head. I think that's probably what they use, you know, because it's got massive eyes.
Do you think there was an executive who came up with the, you know, like one of these executive television executives? He'd watched American Wolf in London and he goes, that's the idea. Yeah. Jumping on the bandwagon. It's all this jumping on the fucking bandwagon.
Well, that's what Glenn A. Larson was good at. Glenn A. Larson got sued a lot because he was just ripping off other shows. I mean, apparently he was just ripping off the Rockford Files left, right and centre. Just because there were so many episodes of that. They thought, oh, they won't realise I've nicked the whole plot. And he got sued by Jim James Garner.
Well, the Rockford Files is always regarded as a great show, isn't it? I mean, really good. Mm. And I think David Chase was behind a lot of the Rockford Files. Chase went on to do The Sopranos, didn't he?
Well, that's funny. Yeah, because yeah. Manimal's character was Jonathan Chase. Maybe that was a nod to David Chase.
Do you remember a show, Lee, called The Gemini Man? And it only ran maybe two or three episodes or something. We were quite excited about it in our house. We thought it was quite good. But apparently
I've definitely heard of it.
It was absolutely sort of blitzed off the air. It just
70s, I think it's because it?
But certainly, when we're talking 80s, we can safely say Stephen J. Cannell. And I always used to go, Cannell. There's another Cannell. Fucking hell. Here we go again. And he was... was it Magnum? I think he might have done. And I think he had something to do with the A-Team, didn't he? I think Stephen J. Cannell had something to do with the A-Team. Now, we're talking the ultimate sort of superhero-type crime fighters in the A-Team. But the leader of them, George Peppard, right, looked about as fit as a pensioner in a care home or something, you know? Always... hilarious. You know, he looked to me like he was doing it. George Peppard was doing that show by the numbers. He really looked like he was fagged out. He'd had enough, you know.
I've got to admit, Dave, I loved the A-Team when I was a kid.
Oh, me too.
I look forward to it so much on Friday nights. But they always had a similar plot each episode. Because
exactly.
From what I can remember, it always seemed to be like there would be a brother and sister running a small business. Now that was important to have the brother and sister rather than a couple, because that would leave a girl there for Face to harass for the whole episode. Right. So they had a brother and sister, and there was a bigger company just down the road that did the same thing, like say a car wash, and they would send their heavies in to put the little guys out of business, wouldn't they? Sending the revs in to smash up the place and threaten them. And then they'd find the A-team. Obviously, the question of how you're going to pay us comes up. And they always had like a family heirloom or an insurance policy they could cash in. So that's generally how they got paid. And then it would just be fighting, wouldn't it, for about the next half an hour. Until the A-team got trapped in a barn and had to turn a tractor into a tank that fired potatoes that burst out of the barn and eliminate the enemy. But obviously there was always a bit where they had to break Murdoch out of hospital, get BA on a plane, you know. So it did become very formulaic, but massively enjoyable, I thought.
Hugely enjoyable. And I think one of the things that was always prevalent in those episodes was, I always remember there was always a stunt. It's almost like every week in the A-team, there was a stunt where a truck would turn on its side. It would get blown up and turn its side. And very often you could see the bolt, because what they used to do to get that effect was they'd use like a bolt underneath the truck and throw it on its side, wouldn't they? So, and that was almost every week in the A-team. So you'd always have those same triggers in the storyline every week, wouldn't you? They'd have to go on a plane somewhere, and Mr. T would go, "You ain't going on a plane, fool!" like this. And of course, someone would stab him in the neck with something to knock him out. And that was that. Because you'd start off and Face would pick up a letter from someone like you say, saying, "Please help us, A-team. We really need your help."
Because, let's not forget Hannibal's amazing disguises, like Basil Rathbone's Sherlock Holmes.
So Hannibal, who was like Sherlock Holmes, was always in disguise to begin with, on some other job.
Didn't he work as the swamp thing?
Yeah, he was always an actor or a stuntman, wasn't he? Yeah. He was always doing like bit parts and things. And then you'd get the letters saying, "Please help us, A-team." Literally, they were saying, "We're basically in the same storyline of the Magnificent Seven. We're the poor villagers who need help." Because that's the story to the A-team every week. It was basically the plot of the Magnificent Seven.
Well, apparently, Dave, it was pitched as a combination of The Dirty Dozen, Mission Impossible, The Magnificent Seven, Mad Max, and Hill Street Blues, with Mr. T driving the car.
I love that. That's brilliant.
I didn't know it had any Mad Max elements in it.
Maybe it's making something out and out is the Mad Max thing. I don't know. But that's the other thing. So Howling Mad Murdoch would get caught in a room with Mr. T, and then they would have to... So Howling Mad Murdoch was figuring out how they were going to do it. And Mr. T was like, "What are you doing, fool? You crazy fool!" Yeah. Like this. Face was getting rapey with the local girl, you know, as he did every week. And like you say, Hannibal was in disguise, badly, I might add, really badly. George Peppard was desperately trying to suck his stomach in with his kind of safari jacket that he always wore.
He loved that, didn't he?
And his big cigar. Oh, God, marvellous. Marvellous times had by Hall.
I wonder how Peppard got cast in that, you know, because it's quite an interesting bit of casting. Because to me, I never thought they looked old enough, or at least Face and Mr. T didn't look old enough to have served in NAM. But I suppose if you think the average age was 19, then obviously they did.
Well, Peppard's dead, isn't he? And I reckon all the others are now in their 70s, aren't they now, I would think. And the guy who played Howling Mad Murdoch, he actually did some quite good serious roles later on in life.
Dwight Schultz,
that's his name, yes. I think he's an actor. I think he played Oppenheimer in Fat Man and Little Boy, the film about the atomic bomb.
That's Robert Bruce Robinson, isn't it, who wrote that?
Yeah.
He did write. Yes. You're dead right, Dave, yeah.
I think, and a couple of other things too, you know.
Star Trek, I think he's been in Star Trek.
Yeah. But I couldn't tell you what any... Well, obviously, Mr. T's been in things, but has he really? Actually, thinking about it, has Mr. T been in anything since the A-team? He just professionally is Mr. T. That's it. And then in the occasional advert where he goes, "Fool!"
Well, he had his own hilarious TV show, didn't he? Was it about teaching kids to do the right thing by threatening them?
Brilliant. I'd love him to just have a TV show called Fool. You know, they just, "What are you doing, fool?"
His real name, Dave, is Lawrence Turode. Lawrence Turode.
Turode Road.
Lawrence Turode. But it's Turode. Yes.
Lawrence Turode. Oh, wow. Mm. I say Mr. T. Lawrence Turode, Mr. T. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, okay.
Genius.
Just a nickname.
Isn't it? Calling himself Mr. T. You'd think he would be in more things, wouldn't you? But he's just appeared in other things as himself.
The only characters he's ever played are Clubber Lang and Beer Baracus. He's not really played anything else, has he?
Well, he was brilliant in Rocky III, I thought he was a great bit of casting.
Brilliantly arrogant bastard.
He wanted to get his face smashed in. And he killed Mickey, didn't he? He calls Mickey. Mickey's dead.
He killed Mickey! We all like that. Get him, Rocky. Get him.
Apparently, he didn't get on with George Peppard because George Peppard was jealous of Mr. T being the star of the show, though he always denied these rumours. And Mr. T apparently got paid more than him, so he wasn't happy with that.
Oh, well, I mean, Peppard should have thanked his lucky bloody stars because he was pretty much washed out by then, wasn't he? He did Breakfast at Tiffany's, didn't he, as an actor? I mean, he did a few films and all that, but then he did a TV series called Banachek, didn't he, in the 60s and 70s? And I think that was quite a slick, pretty cool show, but he hadn't done anything for years. And he was initially like the star vehicle of the thing, wasn't he? But obviously, you know, people are going to gravitate to Mr. T.
Yeah, because it was a kid's show. You know, you're going to like a cool, younger, aggressive one. Rather than the old guy.
Yeah. Shall we talk now about the crime show that actually featured a murderer in the starring role along with
alleged murderer? Go on then.
He's not going to sue us. Don't worry, Lee. He's not going to sue us.
He's quite a guy.
He doesn't want to take this bad boy to court. He doesn't want to do that, baby. He doesn't want to do that.
You're talking about.
You know. I am indeed.
The self-made millionaire, Jonathan Hart.
Yeah. There's Mrs. H. There's Mrs. H. She's gorgeous. God, I'd like to fuck her just like Mr. H.
Well.
God, she's... Whoa, look at Mrs. H. I'd like to stick my hand right up her juice box. Say, whoa, look at Mrs. H. Fucking hell. Oh, I wank outside their room every night thinking about them fucking away.
Well, funny enough, Dave, I did actually sit down and watch an episode of Heart to Heart, purely in terms of research, and I did enjoy it, and it did remind me of just how lightweight these shows were, really. But it was classic Sunday night fare, Heart to Heart. I don't know if in your house, but we always used to watch it.
Wasn't on a Sunday night. It was like, get my kung fu pajamas on, comb my hair, and then it was Heart to Heart, and it was, here's Mr. H. He's a self-made millionaire. Quite a guy. And this is why Mrs. H. She's so fucking fit. She's so fit. I want a spunk on her tits.
By the way, my name is Max.
My name's Max. I'm the butler.
I take care of both of them.
And they've got a little dog called Freeway.
Do you know why it was called Freeway?
I don't know. Tell me.
Because he was found on a freeway.
Oh,
he was
beautiful.
A stray.
He was a stray, and they took him in.
But this episode, right?
Better than beating your wife to death and throw her in the sea.
It starts off with this guy. He's like treating his flowers in the evening, and then you see this figure. Just see his feet, and then you can see him approaching the guy who you later learn he's called Zonadoff Papadopoulos, who's a bit of a gangster. And the person you don't see sprays him with this insecticide, and he coughs himself to death. Then it cuts to the credits, and after that, Jonathan and Jennifer have just woke up with perfect hair and perfect breath. And they start making out, but then Max fucking comes in, puts Jonathan off his stroke, seeing his face.
That he does. He's been wanking outside the door.
And it basically, the plot is about there's this flower competition which Jennifer enters.
Mrs. H has got the best flower.
Well, basically, Max cultivates this flower that he calls the Jennifer Heart. He doesn't want to enter it himself, so she sort of takes ownership of it and she enters the competition. But one by one, the contestants start getting knocked off. And you can see it coming a mile away, because there's one guy that says, oh, I'm allergic to bees. And you think, oh, I know what's coming next. And then he gets attacked by a load of bees in a greenhouse. And then, you know, obviously Jonathan and Jennifer involve themselves and start investigating, put themselves in a bit of jeopardy. They nearly get run over by a driverless truck. Jonathan's running about in his cream suit and ice white shoes. It's all very slick. Does a bit of fighting. But you can see the villain and bloody mile off. There's like this red herring, and you just think, oh, it's not him. It's this other guy. And it basically turns out to be the judge of the show. He's basically killing off the others. Like, I can't even remember the reason now. But it ends up with a bit of a fight. And there's this stuntman with a pathetic, unconvincing bald cap on, who's about twice the size of the actor who's playing, fighting Jonathan, falling down the stairs. But of course, they solve the crime. It's a happy ending. The villain's caught, and that's that. Yeah. But what I found very interesting is that Jonathan can just apparently ring up the cops and ask for like the pathology report.
Yeah.
It's like, well, what's it got to do with you?
Because fucking money talks, doesn't it? You know what I mean? Mr. fucking millionaire gets what he fucking wants, Jonathan Hart. But as a kid, you know, I'm sure you must have been the same, but as a kid, and I would speak to Dave Moss about this, we would go on about how we would love to live that heart-to-heart lifestyle with getting there, you know. The fantasy away from the gritty streets of Manchester, the white dog shit, the early morning bus in the morning, the green snot that you would have in the winter's day back in Manchester, was that beautiful idea of living the life of Jonathan Hart as a young man and having a beautiful wife and a little dog. But I'm not sure about Max. I wouldn't have some old former communist fucking, which is what Lionel Stander was, by the way. He was got in a lot of trouble in the House on American Activities department there back in the day. He was a bona fide communist, Lionel Stander. He was a pretty good guy, to be fair. But I wouldn't want the character of Max just lolling about the house, you know, fucking up, you know. Come on, get some work done. What are you fucking doing? Stop staring at the missus's legs. Dirty old bastard.
I remember hearing some comedian say that Max looked like he had his face turned inside out.
He did. He looked like he had a mouthful of nails, didn't he, was talking. I'm with your aim. Hey, Mrs. H! Fucking Lionel Stander. And he used to wear, he had that kind of really gay look as well at times, because he'd wear like a little a sailor's hat, wouldn't he?
That's right. He would, yeah.
Hey, look at me, I'm a sailor! I like the boys as well as the girls!
Just reading here, right? Because you think, what's Max's job? He's either a butler or general dog's body. But apparently, he was a major domo. His job title was a major domo. It's a person who speaks, makes arrangements, or takes charge for another. Typically, this is the highest person of the household staff. Household staff, right? Head servant.
Okay, so he probably had other staff.
Never saw anyone. Freeway was on the payroll.
I bet he had some like black people and some Chinese, you know, and he was really nasty with them. Hey, come on there, Blackie. Get a move on with the dinner. And like, Mrs. Hong, stop stenching the kitchen out with all that foreign food that you're making and make me and Jennifer some proper American food like burgers and fries of your Chinese filth. Like this, you know. Max, take their belt to them if they do any more of this behaviour. Will do, Mr. H. Tell me, Mr. H, Do you ever fuck Mrs. H up the ass? I'd love to see that. Can I bring a camera to see that, Mr. H?
Oh, God. I've never thought of Max in this way, Dave. You're opening my eyes to the real Max here.
I've been thinking about it all daily. So I'm thinking about Max as this sexual deviant in the Hart household.
Yeah.
You're making me laugh all day. Did she like a fisting? Did she like to get fisted, Mr. H? Funny.
Right.
But it was kind of like popular, wasn't it? Yeah. Very popular, and I think I used to love the fantasy of it, you know, sharing a big round bath. And it was a bit like an Imperial Leather advert, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. But another one, Dave, that you may not have heard of even, but one I did actually used to watch. It was on a Friday night in the 80s, early 80s, about 83, 84, called Cover Up. Right, now this one was another Glenn A. Larson production, and it teamed up a fashion photographer with a special forces operative.
Oh, beautiful. Wow.
I think the story behind it was that the fashion photographer's husband was an undercover agent and she didn't even know about it, and he was killed doing a mission. So when she found out about it, for some reason the CIA or whoever offered her the job, his old job,
right,
and teamed up with his special forces operative who pretended to be her model. So basically what they did is move around the world pretending to be on fashion shoots whilst rescuing trapped Americans.
Oh, wow. Do you know what?
Pretty amazing.
That's probably too original for it to have been popular, you know, it's been a popular show. That's
it didn't last very long. I think the first actor who played the model stroke special forces operative accidentally killed himself on set when he was dicking about with a gun, a prop, and he put it to his head playing roulette. And he fired it, and it was some wadding from a blank that went into his head and dislodged a bit of his skull, which pushed it into his brain and gave him a hemorrhage. And died a week later. So they replaced him, obviously, with another actor. But I don't think it lasted more than one or two series.
There were so many, wasn't there? So many sort of one-offs and one-series things.
Well, I think the gimmick was teaming up people that you would never expect. Like, remember Hardcastle and McCormack?
Well, that rings a bell, yeah, but I couldn't tell you what it was about.
That was a judge and a car thief teaming up.
Was it?
Teaming up. And there was Scarecrow and Mrs. King, Kate Jackson and Bruce Boxleitner. That was a divorced housewife and a CIA operative.
Right.
So I think Glenn A. Larson just put different types of people in a hat and pulled two out. Oh, yeah, we've got an insurance salesman here and a hitman. Let's put them two together.
I quite liked Bruce Boxleitner, but that's another example of what they were doing with those TV shows, because Raiders of the Lost Ark becomes this massive hit. So they make a show called Bring 'Em Back Alive, which is such a kind of rip-off of Raiders of the Lost Ark or King Solomon's Mines or what have you, with Bruce Boxleitner as this game hunter or something, but he's actually bringing back people who are fugitives or something. And then there was another one. So what I think one was on ITV, and there was another show from America too. I think it was called Tales of the Gold Monkey. And that was so Indiana Jones. And they were like competing against each other. And all it was trying to do was climb on the back of the success of the Raiders films, you know. And that would have been mid-80s as well. But what was the situation with Crazy Like a Fox? Because that was the great Jack Warden, wasn't it?
And yeah, well, wasn't he a retired cop and his son was a lawyer?
I was going to say it's his son. That's right. It's a bit like TV, the two doctors, the father and son doctors we were talking about, with Tony Britton and Nigel Havers. And that was not written by that Lawson fellow, wasn't it?
No, it was George...
George Layton, not Lawson. George Layton. Yeah, it was a bit part actor. I thought, God, that's quite a sophisticated plot for George Layton, who usually plays a mechanic in Minder. But yeah, but that's right. So he was a cop and his son was a lawyer. That's right. And that was Jack Warden. So there's always some spin, wasn't there? Beautiful.
People did lap them up, didn't they? And they were always big over here.
Huge.
It was one series, Dave, that may stray into the 90s, but I hope you let me have it in, because it's so hilarious, the premise. It's Baywatch Nights.
Oh, my
God. Hasselhoff, he carries out his day job, but at night he becomes a private investigator. Did you ever see any of it?
God, never. I never saw any of it.
I was watching the titles are hilarious. You know, loads of shots of Hasselhoff running in slow motion, hiding behind corners with guns and he's got annoying sidekicks as well, you know. But fucking hell, I mean, who come up with that? But they did show it over here. I remember it because it was always that Thursday night slot, wasn't it, Dave, about 10:30, where you'd get the Equalizer. Because the Equalizer, of course.
Well, we're gonna come to that. I thought we'll save the Equalizer till last.
Well, we have covered him on different pods, haven't we? You'd get Magnum on that slot. There was another show that I think was the 80s that was pretty good called The Master with Lee Van Cleef.
Oh, I remember that.
Do you remember that?
Do you know what? Oh, wonderful, because The Master kind of links quite well with the... I think we've got to have a little bit on the Equalizer at the end, but The Master also had this aging guy who was great about The Master. All these fight scenes, which were so obviously not Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Well, the other guy who was in that
loved it.
A guy called Timothy Van Patten, who, if you remember the great film Class of 84, when he played Stegman.
Yeah.
Which is a great film. That was a brilliant 80s film. That. And he also is now a successful director. He directed loads of The Sopranos and all sorts of things.
Wow. Good for him. Brilliant.
But he was good, The Master. I mean...
Oh, The Master. It was always on, like you say, it was late on, so you could stay up and watch it. And it's Lee Van Cleef, so you'd see him in the, you know, the spaghetti westerns. But he was clocking on a bit, you know, and you could see that. And it was all good until he got into those fight scenes. And you'd always have it from a little bit of a distance. You could see this much younger, much more agile guy doing all this kung fu. Wasn't Lee Van Cleef. I loved it. I agree with you. I loved it.
Yeah, it only lasted one series, that.
Did The Invisible Man, was that 80s? Was that early 80s, you know, with David McCallum?
Good question, yeah. I remember that one now. Yeah.
Again, such a strange kind of TV star, David McCallum, because a kind of little, I don't want to be rude, but a little kind of weedy guy becomes this like superstar in the 60s as Ilya Koryakin and then plays the Invisible Man. And I thought that was really good when that came out, though. I didn't think it was quite.
I don't remember much about it. It was 75, actually, so.
Oh, well, there we are then.
Yeah, way earlier now, but.
Sorry, guys. Going into
the 70s. We can let the odd one.
The odd one slip.
Yeah.
But I suppose some of those shows from the 70s was the birth of these kind of crazy out there shows in the 80s that were trying to up the ante time. Because, you know, if you look at like The $6 Million Man, which was brilliant, I thought that was so good.
Yeah.
That was opening the gateway, I suppose, for Man from Atlantis and bloody Manimal and all these other things. And so was also The Invisible Man, you know, something that's a little bit more fantastic in its premise. But a lot of the shows that were actually successful were kind of very formulaic private eye shows, weren't they? Like none more so than something like Magnum, which was sold in a lot of ways on the strength of its leading man. It was very charismatic actor, Tom Selleck, whose hoity-toity boss, was he his boss?
Higgins.
His landlord? Higgins, you know, and his mates. There was this group of kind of quirky characters. So
I never liked Magnum. What was clever about Dave? I never got into him at all.
No, I could see how it worked formulaically because it was all about quirky friends, quirky characters. I think a lot of it was like eye candy for the girls in Tom Selleck, right? Kind of quirky humour and Hawaii. it was pure escapism again. All these shows were built on the idea of pure escapism, weren't they, really?
Yeah.
That's what it was all about.
Yeah.
Another one that was similar, that was on quite a lot, that never quite grabbed me, was Vegas. You know,
Vegas.
Robert Urich as Dan Tanner. Yeah. And it had Tony Curtis in it, didn't it? But my first band, we were called The Dan Tanners. We thought it was a good name for a band.
Yeah.
The one thing I liked about Vegas was he parked his car in his living room, didn't he?
Oh, did he? Right. Oh, we might be running out of them now, Dave.
Well, no, I think that parking the car slickly moves us on, Lee, to the great Hasselhoff again in the one and only Knight Rider.
Can't say I was a big fan of Knight Rider, Dave. I don't remember watching it that much, to be honest. I remember kids at school going on about it, and I felt a bit left out because I think it was on a Monday night, wasn't it? Like in the Dukes of Hazzard slot. And I was always playing out.
Yeah, me too. I think I was outside. If it came on, it just turned me cold. David Hasselhoff, or anything he was in, I never watched Baywatch either. I just couldn't abide it.
No.
You know, I know that lots of people who I was at school with thought it was the bee's knees. Mostly kind of the slow kids.
Yeah. Or the nerdy kids that were into electronics.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, kits. It's amazing.
When we were in Italy, we went to this place called Movieland near Lake Garda. I think I might have told you this. But we queued up for the Knight Rider speedboat ride. Which is kind of, I thought, I never fucking knew Michael Knight had a speedboat, but I think he had a bike, he had a motorbike, he had a car, he had a speedboat,
trying to be Bond, name
it, all with a computer in it. And we went on this massive speedboat that seated about 50 people, and we got shot at by machine guns.
Wasn't Michael Knight supposed to be the man that doesn't exist? Do you remember it? It says, jeez. Michael Knight.
Do you know, the only thing I remember is his black car, some English guy.
Devon.
Devon.
He was called Devon, wasn't it?
Devon. Fucking hell. Such tripe.
Yeah.
Such utter tripe. Now, the Charlie's Angels, that started in the 80s, didn't it? Certainly.
I think 70s like Charlie's Angels. Show.
No, you're right. It probably was 70s.
Yeah.
Because that's when, like, Lee Majors and Farrah Fawcett sort of got together, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because they were both big stars. Now,
great.
Lee Majors made his resurgence from his huge success as Steve Austin, the Bionic Man.
Well, I did think of The Fall Guy for this pod, but I like The Fall Guy. I didn't think it was that ludicrous, really. And he wasn't
just
a really
good old boy.
Yeah, he wasn't really fighting crime. He was just picking up absconders, wasn't he? Though, actually, he did get involved in all sorts, him and Howie.
I was picking up pussy.
I loved Daft Howie. He would always smash up Howie's new truck.
Yeah. So let's move swiftly on from The Fall Guy, because obviously it's too good to be trashing this one. But what about a TV series about helicopters, perhaps, that seemed to be quite a spin-off from a certain Roy Scheider film?
Yeah, talking about that. Yeah, what a boring show that was, I found. Airwolf. With the uncharismatic Jan Michael Vincent playing the cello.
Jan Michael Vincent, fucking, who was he? For fuck's sake. I mean, just the face when he was like, such a miserable fucking square face cunt. Little cunt. Or Ernest Borgnine having to put in all the work.
Yeah, how come they got Borgnine for that? Must have paid him more than any of them.
You're trying so hard to be chirpy. You know? Oh, come on. Come on.
I'm just looking at Vincent's filmography here, and I don't recognise anything apart from the Hooper. It was in Hooper. Fuck all. Oh, the Hardy Boys.
Hooper
Hardy
is a good link.
And Lassie. It's in Lassie.
Yes, Hardy Boys. In Lassie.
Winds of War, he was in.
Oh.
Very long miniseries, I believe. Oh, Nash Bridges. That was that shit cop show with Don Johnson, wasn't it?
Yeah, Don Johnson. Yeah.
And Cheech
McGrin. What's interesting, though, is you've mentioned Hooper. Hooper, of course, was, let's be honest, the inspiration for The Fall Guy, right? Because I remember seeing Hooper pictures, and it was all about stuntman Burt Reynolds, the stuntman, and his sidekick Jan Michael Vincent. Lee Majors does the fall guy, all about stuntman and his sidekicks who are stunt people. Right? Blue Thunder comes along, Roy Scheider, da 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 da. Next thing you know, you've got Night Fucking Hawk, you know, with Jan Michael yawn.
No, it wasn't Nighthawk,
Dave. Early chirp, wasn't it?
It was Airwolf.
Oh, fuck me, sorry. Dave, stop getting your shit TV wrong.
Nighthawk. I love
wasn't
it.
There something called Nighthawk?
Well, it should have been something called Nighthawk, shouldn't there?
Sounds fucking brilliant, that.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah, because he was called Stringfellow Hawk. Oh, that's like a name Cliff Twemlow had come up with.
Do you know what I mean?
Stringfellow. What a brilliant name. Well, let's name him after... There's this character in Britain who runs seedy nightclubs. Let's call him after him.
We'll call him after him and the guy who did the Morris Minor song, Tony Hawk. Stringfellow Hawk.
No, that's Hawk, Dave.
Oh, is it Tony Hawk?
Yeah, Tony Hawk.
Wow.
The skateboarder.
So what was the John Michael Vincent show called again?
Airwolf.
I'm getting it. Airwolf, of course it was. I do sort of remember. Yeah. So Airwolf was a spin-off from Blue Thunder and Fall Guy spin-off from Hooper.
This is it. I think it was a Glenn A. Larson one again, you know, Airwolf. So another rip-off.
Larson was just going around running, masturbating over like Rage of the Lost Ark, saying, yeah, let's do a kind of adventurer who goes, an archaeologist, yeah. We'll call him Philadelphia Peters. No, we'll call him Idaho Smith. That's the name.
I tell you what was a really good show that I used to like, which was that Thursday night slot again. Hunter. You remember Hunter?
Oh,
it's a bit of a rip-off of Dirty Harry, wasn't it?
Yeah,
with Fred Dreyer.
It was also a rip-off of the Steve McQueen film before he died called Hunter. So they hadn't even bothered to change the name. He just said, fuck it.
Was it Fred Dreyer? Yeah.
Yeah, Fred Dreyer.
Bit of a Clint Eastwood lookalike, wasn't he, if you look at him now?
Yeah.
I always quite liked his co-star, Stephanie Kramer, his detective. But, you know, what came from Hunter, like a spoof version of Hunter, was Sledgehammer. Do you remember Sledgehammer?
Gonna say Sledgehammer, but that's really good.
Fucking brilliant.
Sledgehammer and Naked Gun or Police Squad. Police Squad and Sledgehammer were good, weren't they? You know, they were funny.
I'm gonna have to watch some Sledgehammers. Did like that.
Brilliant. But you know, on a different angle, you know, this idea of like taking an idea and putting their own spin on it, which is what the Yanks did. They're very, very clever at that. In a way, because the reality is something like Murder, She Wrote was just Miss Marple, you know, simply like, and she just added, they just added this idea that she was a writer. So basically it was like Miss Marple is actually Agatha Christie playing this role of Jennifer Fletcher, you know.
Jessica.
Oh, gee, I'm getting everything wrong tonight.
Are you close? I was a bit pedantic there.
Angela Lansbury. I know the actor's name.
Oh, I remember Gav saying it should be called Murder She Caused, because everywhere she goes, a murder happens. Everywhere. Yeah. She could be going to a nephew's birthday party, a book signing, a cruise, anywhere she, or a safari, anywhere she goes, there's a murder and she solves it. I mean, surely that's suspicious.
She was worse fucking luck than Bergerac.
He did that premise over about 187 episodes.
I know.
And she's so smug, isn't she? Smuggins.
John Nettles is still doing that now. You know, still fucking going, isn't he?
Well, he's been replaced, hasn't he?
Bergerac left his offshore haven and then came to a little town in the Cotswolds and fucking there's more death, you know? Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, seriously, though, you know, like, the thing with Murder, She Wrote is that, you know, you get a lot of guest stars on it and stuff. And one of them was my dad's former school friend.
What's Don it? Knight. Yeah, that's his name, Don Knight. And Don Knight appeared in loads of like American TV shows, and everything he was in, he still had that Manc accent. All right, there, Jessica. Listen, Mrs. Fletcher, let me tell you something now. But he was cast as an Irishman or a Scotsman and stuff. It's in a film with Dean Martin where he's supposed to be a Scotsman in it. And he talks like that, you know what I mean? He came from Normandy.
Just looking at him here, Dave. Yeah.
Amazing, isn't it?
He was in Cannon, Kojak,
Cannon,
Hawaii 5-0.
He's in them all.
Manic.
Mission Impossible.
Banachek. He's like the link for all what we've talked about tonight. It must have been heart to heart at one point.
He was in one in the 80s called The Bermuda Triangle that was very short-lived. And he plays the baddie in the first episode. And he's like, what are you doing here then? You know, what's going on here for fuck's sake? If you get a chance to see some Don Knight clips, mate, you'll see exactly what I mean. It's hilarious. I think he was in the year below my dad at school. And my dad knew him very well. And then he emigrated to America when my dad was about 15 and he was 14. And then next thing you know, he was in Kojak.
Fantastic.
Yeah, crazy. Crazy life.
Any final thoughts on this genre of TV show, Dave?
Well, I think we might just have to leave it, though, with talking about perhaps the greatest of all the crime genre formulaic TV shows of the 1980s, to just mention once again, The Equalizer.
Oh, yes.
Hey, Equalizer, man! Hey, Equalizer! What do you want? What are you doing, you thug? I am here on the subway train. I want to go to my home, to my apartment on the east side of the city, and you, sir, are annoying me. I just want to pull a gun on you, you goddamn limey prick.
Just need your wallet, man.
Do that, and I will break your arm in four places and dislocate your clavicle, you horrible little man. You come here, goddamn Equalizer.
How did you know my name? I'm undercover. My name is Robert
McCall. Never
call
me by that name. Do you hear me? fabulous.
Equalizer now played by Queen Latifah. For fuck's sake. What happened there?
How did it get as well such a big idea that it ended up being a Denzel Washington film?
I know. I think they made two, didn't they?
It's amazing. But I just imagine, what happened? How did it come about? I just imagine Edward Woodward walking into that office of some big shot agent or big shot TV producer in America with a big cigar. You know, come in, Edward, sit down. I certainly shall. Thank you, sir. Can I get you a drink? Yes, I'll have a scotch and a cup of tea. And I'll have some Benson and Hedges cigarettes while I'm talking to you. And there he was, like slightly portly, 5'9" in Cuban heels, 5'8", right? Thinning hair, very grey, heart condition.
Yeah, but he looked like George Peppard, Dave.
Yeah, he looked like George Peppard, yeah. Smoking a fuck. He goes, I see you as a goddamn fucking MI6 operative with so many goddamn SAS skills that you can take out the worst kind of goddamn criminal in the Bronx. Do you hear what I'm saying, Edward? Of course I can. That's what I was born to do, sir. I love it, Edward.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant, though. Brilliant. Right. I'm just watching some clips of him now. He can run fast in his long, thick coat.
Hiding all the steak dinners that he's had and the port, cheese and wine. Hiding all sorts of ills under that big coat is Edward Woodward there. So you still had in the 80s that the black copper tended to be the frustrated police chief or the, you know, the angry, you know, copper.
Was it,
you know,
Captain Dobie?
Captain Dobie in Starsky and Hutch.
I loved Captain Dobie.
So the real stereotypes, Captain Dobie would be the, you know, you'd either have the grizzled cop like Captain Dobie or the pimp, of course. And the pimp, you know, with Huggy Bear. And the great thing, I suppose, that in Starsky and Hutch was Huggy Bear was like a great mate. So you would have the Aryan, the Jew, and the Black all friends together. You see, it was like the meeting of minds in Starsky and Hutch. I just fucking love Starsky and Hutch.
That iconic bit where they're in the rain.
Oh man, it was so good. I loved all the characters in it, and
the car was amazing.
Do you know what's difficult, Lee, is? I think the difficulty is with these American shows in the 80s, for me, they didn't live up to what I saw in the 70s. Because in the 70s, all those shows, and we're saying that at the beginning, weren't we, really? But all those shows seemed more captivating.
They were edgy, weren't they?
They had more of an edge to them. Starsky and Hutch, Kojak. I mean, unfortunately, Kojak did have some pretty terrible racial stereotypes. The famous black actor Bill Duke, he plays the worst pimp in it of all time. It's so stereotypical. And he's like, David Kojak, hey Kojak, I ain't been doing nothing wrong, I've just been looking after my bitches. It's unbelievable.
Sounds a bit like Huggy Bear.
Huggy Bear's a little Huggy was, I don't think he'd call him his bitches. He goes, my girls. Hey,
what was his real name, Huggy Bear? Marion Van...
Van Peebles or something.
No, it wasn't quite a good name, Van Peebles. Antonio Fargas it was, actually.
Antonio Fargas.
Did you ever hear Bill Bailey doing the music, playing his guitar to Starsky and Hutch? He goes... He'd be doing it, he'd go, as soon as Huggy Bear appears, he'd be like... like a really sort of laid back version of the theme.
It would be. Antonio Fargas would always appear in his bar, wouldn't he? He'd always have a tip off for Starsky Nuts because he was a fucking stool pigeon, really, wasn't he? He was a dirty fucking grass for the white man. He was shitting on his brothers. Hey, Starsky. Hey, Hutch. I got some info on one of my brothers who I'm snitching on. My oppressed brother.
Doggy Dog is based on Antonio Fargas. Huggy Bear.
Some of my brothers are raiding some honkies, and I'm going to snitch on them to you two white boys. It's like Huggy Bear, the little capitalist pig that he is. And he's one of the heroes in the show. What the fuck's going on?
Amazing.
Fargas, man, he's still going strong. The three of them are still there, still going. Come on, bring it on. We should do a new one. Starsky and Hutch revisited now. Can you imagine a Starsky and Hutch show now? Great, but I can still remember all the theme tunes of all of them, mate. Listen to this, right? So forget Starsky and Hutch for the minute, because there was three theme tunes for Starsky and Hutch. But Canon was this. Right. It's kind of like, sounds like a fat man, doesn't it? Right. Kojak was. And famously at school, I could do the Rockford Files all the way through, including the guitar solo, right, in the middle. So not just a
But you're right, they all had great
theme tune heaven.
They had great theme tunes, didn't they? And great opening titles, because there was always a bit of a narrative as well, like the A-Team. At the Soldiers of Fortune, accused of a crime they didn't commit. Exciting. It made it exciting, really. Yeah, for somebody. Yeah. And the one I loved to watch with my mum on a Friday night was Petrocelli.
Loved Petrocelli. Yeah. Oh my God, loved it. Building his house forever.
Building his
fucking house. Ah, yeah. Petrocelli was great. And of course, everyone loves the Starsky Nuts, which is the Tom Scott theme. But Nelson Riddle did a brilliant theme too, which went. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one ever remembers that.
Yeah.
Starsky and Hutch had two of the best theme tunes ever.
What was the one? What was the Y5O's, Dave? Was that?
Of course, Sammy Davis Jr. did some lyrics to that, didn't he? If you want me to love you, it's hilarious. It's one of the worst songs ever written. It's amazing. Sammy Davis Jr. going, and it's something like, if you let me love you, I'll be yours tonight.
Jack Lord. Movies.
Oh, yeah, Jack Lord. That went into the 60s. I think it might have started late 60s, now I have. Certainly early 70s. Mission Impossible as well. You know? And again, I know for a fact, Don Knight was definitely in Mission Impossible.
Yeah, he was.
And what a theme tune. Lalo Schifrin, bloody Schifrin theme tune. Wow. Brilliant. Halcyon Days. So I think this is quite nice that we've covered these great shows in the 70s. So those 80s shows were up against it, I'm afraid. I don't think they could quite live up to...
Shallow. Very of the time, weren't they?
Exactly. They're so memorable that I called Airwolf Nighthawk. I mean, that's... Just, I wish... Where's the show Nighthawk? That would have been great.
Yeah, Nigel Knight and Springfellow Hawk.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Knight with a K. Nighthawk.
I mean, how the fuck did Glenn A. Larson miss that opportunity?
How did he miss out there? Fuck me.
I think we should wrap it up, Dave.
We've done that on the wing and a prayer, especially me tonight. I've done it on a total wing and a prayer.
That's what I mean. I mean, I did think, well, I've not really had a chance to read about these shows much. And
oh, but you've been good, Lee. Yeah. You've remembered loads. I've just been fucking talking shite.
No, you haven't.
But I've been enjoying it.
We're going to have to think of a good theme tune to play out, Dave. And I'll let you pick that one.
Oh, right. Okay. Theme tune from those shows. Oof, gosh. Let's have a think. From the 80s. Maybe, I tell you what we should finish with, because we've talked about it as the ultimate kind of hilarious 80s crime show. It's got to be Stuart Copeland's music for The Equalizer.
Good choice. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, folks.
And we'll be back soon. So take care, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye.